Yes, welcome back, coaches, to the Talking Split podcast. I am Rob Calder, once again joined by our good friend Zoe Carr. Welcome, Zoe.
Thank you for having me.
Jenna O'Hay, welcome, Jenna.
Hello.
And a little bit of Lord of the Rings for everyone just to start off the show. Thanks for jumping in once again. You can follow along on the Talking Split socials where you can find us on the at Talking Split handle on X and Instagram. Once again, I've just realised I haven't posted the video that we had on Saturday, so I will get that done by the time this podcast drops. Apologies, I'm terrible at this as it turns out. We do have a quick coach shout out to begin with. So AJ Johnson out of the Camberwell Dragons, under 16 ones head coach and so much more. AJ spends a lot of his lifetime in basketball. AJ doesn't just focus on his team, he involves the entire under 16 boys squad into the Sunday sessions and looks for improvement and development, which has seen results follow. His success is driven by raising expectations each time a goal is met. So a team that has started off just aiming for VC and not only competing at the National Classic, but grabbing a bronze medal as well. So great job, AJ. Appreciate, as always, the coach shout-out. If you do have anything, please, by all means, send them in and we'll happily shout-out any of the coaches in this world. Big week for Australian basketball, in particular Victorian basketball, which is Australian basketball, as every other state just groans as I say that. Apologies to everyone. But what looks like to be another Australian NBA draftee this week. So we've already had two of the three women drafted to the WNBA this year in Izzy Borlase, Nards Poch and Jad Shelley. So it looks like we're going to have another one this week in Johnny Furphy that's come through the Basketball Victorian pathway. So the hope is, Portland, come on, like, we live in hope that we might get someone that I actually
if
like
they
on our roster.
If they get him, they'll trade him.
Yeah, big chance. if we get, yeah, you're absolutely right too. If we don't get him, he'll
the
turn
Portland
into.
Portland way.
Yeah, Jesus, I'm starting shaking while I'm sitting here at the moment. But it's one of those things too that's obviously a really cool thing for the sport to have yet another NBA person. Like, I remember growing up and we were talking about, like, Boomers and Opals and those types of things, and Luke Longley was kind of the only guy that was playing NBA at that stage, and it's like, oh, we just hope that he would come and play at one of our tournaments at some stage. Now we're in a position where there's a potential that NBA players are going to get left off national team rosters. So when you look at the health of the sport overall, fantastic. Johnny Furphy is a really interesting case, and one in particular that I think is worth discussion, in that we're seeing a lot of stuff now about, oh, I never made state teams, and it's not because he wasn't picked due to a lack of ability. He just wasn't ready yet at that sort of stage. It's under 16s in particular, there's such a mass turnover of players. Like, I know every year I was the head coach in that world, by the time they come through to under 18s, five or six of those kids have changed over from 16s to 18s. It's just such a massive turnover of kids. This is a really interesting case because I remember Johnny in 16s, who was the scrawny little kid that there's a picture lying around on one of our laptops somewhere. Looks like a surfer kid. Like, looks like he has no interest in basketball. Looks like just a really young kid that just played. Wasn't ready in 16s. Probably wasn't really ready in 18s. Under 20s, got an opportunity with the Navy team. Credit to Ash Arnott that had him in SDP all the way through. Like, identify that this kid's got something about him with the whole IQ, the way he plays, the way he sees the game. Had him in SDP, but knew he was probably going to be a bit of a slower burn as to when he was going to be ready. Great story to just, one, stick with it, but two, the whole late developers in the sport too, which is just such a big part of the world we live in. I think everyone wants ready-made players now, but there's not a whole lot of patience to how they get there. Like, have you seen much of that, Zoe?
Heaps. It's actually quite frustrating, if I can be brutally honest, because the whole point of development programs, you know, that they didn't make a state team until now, or they never made a state team, even though they did. The whole point is that they've actually been in the development programs the whole way through. And so something that frustrates me a lot, and it might be getting a bit conspiracy theory here, so strap in.
No, I love a conspiracy theory. You know this is my world.
It frustrates me that the media will grab, you know, this particular story. I watched the story on the news last night about Furphy and how he never made a state team until he was 17, as if that's like over the hill. But then us as a basketball fraternity jump on that and start, you know, making ridiculous public statements. I saw at least three of them yesterday on social media from people who should know better. But what irritates me is, and here's the conspiracy theory part, from a sports media perspective in Australia, particularly in Victoria, our sports media is very heavily owned by the AFL. And why, what would they have to gain by making a statement like that? I think it's pretty obvious what they have to gain of, you know, AFL don't make these mistakes, only other sports make those mistakes. And then we, instead of banding together and saying, no, we understand that, you know, this kid was a long-term developer and he needed time to, you know, just grow into his body and, you know, have those skills come together. We don't go down that path. We jump on that as well. So now it's not just other sports coming at us. It's from within as well. That's the disappointing part for me, because at the end of the day, you know, the people in the know, and you said one in particular, Ash Arnott, who was massive in the development of that particular athlete, there was a plan. There was a plan in place, and there was always going to be a time where he developed and it all came together, but you just had to be patient enough to wait. And I think the impatience to wait for development, but also the willingness to jump on anything just because you might have an axe to grind about something else, I don't know. It's just really disappointing, and it makes me really upset for the people who put in so much work. And this should just be a good moment. There shouldn't be any of this, you know, negativity surrounding it. We should all just be really happy that this kid's got it together and he's about to get an unbelievable opportunity.
Yeah, so it's just different paths, Jenna. Well, that's kind of the thing. Like, not everyone is built the same way. Like, you look at when you came through the state team pathway as a player, I'm tipping it looks very different to what it looks like now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think conversely, you see those kids who grow really early. And so they dominate under 14s and under 16s. And then by the time they get to under 18s, these kids, like a Johnny Furphy, have grown and matured and they catch up. So it goes both ways. You can have late developers, you can have early developers. No path is going to be the same. They're not all linear.
Yeah.
So I think that's something that we really need to remember.
Yeah, and it's a great point in that there are so many kids that do develop early that don't go any further than that because they've developed ill. They never had to get the extra string to their bow. They never had to try and find ways to be able to stick the shot from a certain area because they didn't have to. They could just rebound, put back, and life was good. I'm looking at my under 12 career in particular at this point. Like, I never got tested. Like, this is ironic that my playing career is in the same conversation as a Furphy one. But it's one of those areas too where we do have to just take stock of a couple of things, and it's like, well, okay, is this pathway right for this person? Is it going to be slightly different for someone else? Do they need the same things? Like, I look at like Furphy in particular. That's a kid that was playing for Melbourne Uni in Big V, but his coach Sean King managed his minutes, would put him in at times where it's like, hey, this is not going to hurt you to play now. You're playing against adults. This is a good time. This is not the right time. This is the time where you need to sit and watch. Those types of things makes such a massive difference. Having a coach that's actually got a bit of a plan in place for you goes a really long way. So if there are players listening to this, and there's always a couple, really lean into those coaches in particular that have a plan in place that you can actually tap into a little bit, and it's like, well, what's next for me? And it doesn't mean you have to be that serial pest with what's next, what's next, what's next, what's next. Sometimes you just need to do a really good job where you're at and get that right before you start looking at what's next, because where you're at might not be the end result, I would hope.
But also, not everyone's going to become a Johnny Furphy.
No, of course not.
A late developer. Like, it's you, like Jenna and myself in our roles, we're constantly having to take punts on kids in the hope that it works. But, you know, more often than not, it doesn't, because you have to have this unique blend of physical attributes, obviously skill set, but then the mental attributes. You've got to be a competitor. You've got to love it. You've got to want to be good. You've got to have all of that in together. And I think it's Mike McHugh always says, most only have two out of three. And the ones that, you know, that become the Johnny Furphy. They've got all three. Doesn't mean you can't have a good career. Doesn't mean you can't love playing basketball or love being involved in basketball. But I'm just, I suppose I'm just trying to warn that not all plans lead to the NBA or the WNBA. Some plans might lead you to your ceiling, which might be NBL one, might be coaching. It might be something, you know, it might be running a club or, you know, something like that, something off court. But yeah, I think it's really important that we look at it from a bit more of a realistic, you know, we don't want to, I'm not trying to douse anybody's fire, but, you know, understand too that just because you've got a plan doesn't mean it, you know, comes to fruition just because you want it to.
Yeah, and that's difficult to hear at times.
Absolutely. Like it's horrible.
Yeah, like nobody wants to be retired by their coach. I was at the age of 14. they put me on the coaching
pathway. But would you say that was the best thing for you though? Like,
it didn't make me a
better
player.
At the time it was
sure.
awful, but
yeah, it sucked. But
it's led you into a life, yeah, a life of coaching and your job and...
Yeah, and isn't the life of coaching a glorious one that we all that we all deal with? No, I'm being a touch facetious. But yes, in all honesty, it's go around the people that can actually help and assist you. And, you know, I don't know if, again, conspiracy theories, I don't know if my algorithms have shifted a lot, but I'm getting a lot of European travel, tick, on my socials, so I'm good with that one. Pizza, also tick. but skills trainers, like basketball skills trainers appearing on my social media stuff at the moment, and it drives me mental, in particular when I hear some of the things that are being said about, here's how you can go from a fourth team to a first team. It's like, if only it was that simple. Everyone would do the same thing. You do realise there are only a certain amount of spots available too. Well, we were talking about it before, and it's like, well, 30 years ago, when you had to try and pick a state team, it wasn't super difficult because there weren't as many people playing. You could probably go and pick the eyes out of just, hey, these look like our best 10 players, go away and win, and you'd be okay. Now, we have the same amount of spots, but we now have quadruple the amount of people playing and wanting to try out for those spots. Your talent ID is so much different now compared to what it used to be, because you are also looking for an intangible. Where is the person that may not fit right now but might be the person in 4 years' time that you don't want to leave out of the sport because they you sort of need to find a way to keep them going along at the same time? But then you've got to have that conversation about, look, you know, now is not your time. How do you package that so that they don't get disenchanted with the sport? Or that's hard.
And I think on that, you're never going to make every single team that you try out for. And if I look at my career, yeah, I missed out on things. And I think it's how you look at it and how you bounce back from that. Is it, oh, that coach doesn't like me and thinking of all these excuses? Or is it, no, I need to go out and work on X, Y, and Z to get better. So next time when I come back, I am going to make that team. So I think it's how we look at ourselves in those moments that really matter. And it doesn't always have to come from a coach saying you need to work on X, Y, Z. I think we can be really self-aware and be like, yeah, I can do this a little bit better. Maybe coach has given me feedback and I haven't taken that on board. Like how are you going away from those moments matters for the next time you show up?
Yep. I like that a lot. Well, as a coach, very rarely do we sit there and say, you know what, I'm going to leave out a player that I think can win me games. Like, there is no coach alive that does that. If they think that you can win them a game, they will pick you.
And sometimes good basketball players and very skillful basketball players are going to miss out on teams because their attitude's not up to it.
Yep.
I feel like a lot of players are very good at basketball, but their attitude is letting them down. That they don't listen to their coach, that they roll their eyes, that they're not supporting their teammates. Those things matter as well. So it might not just be your skills on a basketball court. Everything goes into how you put a team together. Yep. So there's so much more that goes into picking a team of 10 or 12 than just basketball skill.
When you talk about juniors, if we've got a level two kids that we can't split for the last position, you know, we'll look at the parents. And I know that's a bit jarring at times, but if we cannot split them for, you know, through a skill set, through their attitude, what you're talking about, Jenna, we'll look at their parents. Who's going to be easier to deal with? Because both kids are exactly the same. let's make sure that then the harmony of the group and the parent group is taken into consideration as well. We'll never penalize a kid on their parents' behavior, but it can also help if you're down to those last couple of spots. So attitude is so important, and what you're talking about, Jenna, is unbelievably important. And you're not saying that it's you don't get to be disappointed. Of course you do. Of course you can be disappointed you've missed out on a team. You want something and you've missed it. But, yeah, how do you bounce back from that? Do you make a ton of excuses, and do you surround yourself with people who allow you to make those excuses, or do you pick the eyes out of, you know, yourself and your abilities or your where you need to go or what they need from you, and do you surround yourself with people who can help you get there?
And I think that's what Johnny Furphy has done.
Yeah.
And I wish him the best of luck to go as high as possible.
Yeah, Portland, if we can. Like, fingers crossed, I need someone likable on my roster. Like, it's just one of those things. But it's a phenomenal story. And it is a nice reminder to everyone that the pathway isn't always a straight line. There are plenty of little road bumps and all that sort of stuff. Sometimes the pathway doesn't start until later for some people. Like, I know plenty of people that have missed out on teams and said that was actually the best thing for me. Like, I needed a little bit of a kick to potentially miss out on something and make me work a little bit harder at various things too. So it's not for everyone. I understand that. People will still want to make everything. I also understand that. Like, we heard a story this morning about an under-12 parent that was devastated because they were going to be away for the first round of trials because they were going on a European vacation. It's like, you know what, go on the European vacation, under-12 trials, you'll be okay. Like, this is not the end of the world. You'll be all right here. If you're good enough, you'll be found. And I genuinely believe that. Yeah. We can talk about it as much as we want. If you are good enough, you will be found by the right person at the right time, and you'll go to where you're meant to go in that sort of space. So best of luck to Johnny. Again, come on, Trailblazers. We'll just hope for the best. Like, it's a bleak life I have as a supporter of that team. But anyway, topic for this week, passing in particular. Now, we touched on the why Jenna and I hate bounce passes in transition last week. turns out Jenna does not. But
I used to make them all the time.
I hate them. I hate
them. Hilarious.
Yeah, but you put enough sauce on them.
I do, yeah.
That's the difference. There's very few that, you know, have it, yeah, kick up so you can actually catch it with momentum, not have to slow down. Anyway, I'm sure you spoke about that last week.
We did. Thanks for listening. But passing is one of the things that comes up a lot when we talk to our players, and in particular our coaches. It's like, oh, we just turn the ball over like it is going out of fashion. We have no care for it. It's just we're flipping with what we throw, those types of things. Jenna, I'm curious to get your definition on this to start off with. What for you is a good pass or a bad pass? Is there something that categorically you can say that?
Good question. I think at the end of the day, if it comes off, then the coach on the sideline is probably going to say it's a good pass.
Yep.
And I think what's a good pass for one player might not be a good pass for another player. So I don't think it's as easy as yes and no, or good pass, bad pass. I think the context changes within age groups, within players, within everything. So no, I don't really have a straightforward answer for that because basketball is not straightforward.
Yep. Like it. Sorry.
I'd probably say a good pass arrives on target on time to advantage.
Yeah, okay.
So the advantage could just be gaining distance of kicking the ball ahead or something like that. Or it could be something as awesome as like threading the needle with a bounce pass, Jenna.
Full court to a layup.
Shaking with rage here.
but even, because for mine, even just reversing the ball safely is an advantage as well because you're shifting D and all that sort of stuff. So that's, yeah.
Yeah, no, there's nothing wrong with that. Like it's, like the anatomy of a pass is obviously a little bit different for everyone. Like for mine, any pass that can't be caught is a bad pass. Like that's the reality. Like you can't rifle a ball to an 8-year-old and expect him to catch it and say, but it was a great pass. No, it wasn't a great pass. The receiver dictates a part of that too.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing because I see a lot of people not leading for the ball, holding off their players. So it could have been a good pass, but it's between two people. So
or the passer, the passer can't make the pass, and everyone's saying, kick the ball ahead. And it's like, well, who? They've actually made the right decision.
Yep, absolutely. And that's a really big part of it. Like, I know I've got on a lot of my point guards over the years for not kicking the ball ahead. And it was only that one of them bit back on me in a moment of frustration. And it's like, well, who would you want me to throw it to? None of your wings run the lanes. And it's like,
got me.
Okay, I retract it. Like, it's a fair point, but it's a legitimate thing that it is a two-person relationship where it's not just about the pass and how it gets there. It is about the receiver. So that is hands up, making sure you can see the ball. Like, if you're a lane runner, chin on inside shoulder, target hand up, all those types of things that we all sort of talk about a little bit. But how often do we go into the detail of that as well as to look, if you want the ball, you have to put yourself in a position where you can get the ball. That might be, how do you lead? How do you get open in the first place? Those types of things. There's so much more that goes into it. And a lot of the times we just see turnover on a box score and say, well, coughed it up six times, that's not a good night for you. And it's like, well, actually, it wasn't really their fault. They might have been just handed the ball at the end of a shot clock.
Funny that you say that, because there's a lot of stuff about Caitlin Clark at the moment with that exact thing.
Yeah, right.
Because she loves kicking it ahead. And they generally look like, I don't know, pretty good passes. It's hitting players on the hands they're not able to catch. Is that a good pass? Is it a bad pass?
Yep.
And so that's a lot of discussion on social media at the moment with Caitlin Clark, saying her teammates aren't quite at her level. But at the same time, is that if that keeps happening, then she might have to come to her teammates' level too.
Yeah, I think, and I am that person, we all...
The one at the lower level?
No, you'll see where I'm going with this in a second. We all had people on our teams that it's like, even if I throw that to them, they're probably going to drop it. I'm the person that would drop it. Like, it's... So you have to be a little conscious too that, are they open? Yes. Is the ball going there a good idea? Maybe not.
See, I was always one of those people that I'm going to throw it to, if they're open, I'm going to throw it to them, because if I don't, they'll never learn.
Yep.
And I can't remember what coach it was, told me if you go at their head, they're more likely to catch it.
Zoe just raised her hand, which is fantastic for an auditory medium. But there's something to it. And I'll put this in cricketing context, because that's where I played the majority of my sport as a junior in particular. If you had to have me sit underneath a ball that had been skied for like 15 seconds to catch the thing, there was a far greater risk of me dropping that thing than if you just rifle that thing at my head. Self-preservation will take over eventually, where a hand will go up and, you know, more often than not, you sort of stick those ones because it's just reflexes. You don't actually have to think about it too much. I think there's something to that too. Like, you've got to make sure that you are throwing it to someone that can catch it and do something with it. Because if you're that guard that's in the back court that just sort of says, hey, my trailing big's over there, we'll just turf it to them and they get run and trapped, that's your turnover just as much as it's their turnover. You've got to be mindful of that sort of stuff too.
Well, I see it so much, and I'm sure Jenna sees exactly the same. We have a cutter and they're open, but they're not on. And that's what I speak to the girls all the time. Yes, she's open in that you can make the pass without a deflection or without a steal, but when she catches it, what is she going to do with it? There's three people behind her ready to just swamp her as soon as she gets that catch.
As the passer, you can see that.
As the passer, you can see.
Well, you should be seeing that.
But as the passer, yes, it is your job to see, obviously, your defender, the cutter's defender, but then that second line of defence, that's what you've got to see as well. And we've all seen, I think we spoke about this a couple of weeks ago on the pod, we've all seen bigs post up and they think they're open and the pass doesn't come and they like drop their hands, like crack it a little bit because they can't see what's behind
them. You used to do that to me.
I did. No, I didn't. I never did. Mine was, just get me the ball and then I'll pass it back to you and you shoot it, all right?
Full Jackie Moon.
Yeah, it was, if you need. But that's something that's really important as a passer. You need to be able to make that decision. And I find myself constantly telling our athletes at the moment, just because she yells for it doesn't mean she gets it. Like, we hear a, yes, bang, they throw it. It's like, no, she's not on. She's not on. Sometimes she's not even open. But because we hear that, you know, and they're so confident that they think they're open, we just throw it. So a good passer has the ability to distinguish between and to sort of block that sort of stuff out. But to see second line of defense in any situation, whether it be post-penetration, you know, whatever it is, and make the decision as to who they need to find, whether it's, you know, the person on the cut or faking it to them and then skipping it to the person who's actually open on the other side, which was often Jenna.
Corner three.
But, I mean, you make a great point here, because I think if you were to survey our players at the moment and say who are the great passers, they pick out the ones that throw the no-look passes or thread the needle and those types of things. It's like, well, look, yeah, okay, good passes. But in a lot of cases, the good passes are the ones that deliver it safely to where it needs to get to. And you think about point guards, obviously, because they tend to be the ones. But you look at Jokic in the NBA, like a 7-foot-tall bag of milk. Like, it's, you know, realistically.
A bag of milk.
Yeah. That's how I heard him referred to the other day. I'm sticking with it.
It's like, not wrong.
Doesn't look like he's in the greatest of nick, but that guy can play at a ridiculous level because his vision and how he throws the ball is just next level. So it doesn't always have to be this flashy pass that, oh, look at that. I didn't even see them there. Like, we've all seen the player that makes the pass and then looks away after they've, yeah. Genius move, Rob, like doing that as I'm looking away from the microphone. But it's one of those things.
It's not,
it's
a,
like,
visual medium.
No, yeah. I'm acutely aware every
I
week.
Love that from you, yeah, Jenna. Well done.
Yeah, thank you very much. But it is one of those areas where you sort of look at it and it's like, well, that's not a, like, it doesn't need to be a no-look pass. That's just a pass. Like, that's okay. But the vision part of it, that's kind of the area I'm really interested in more than anything else, is how do you see those passes? Like, what is open for one person as a passer may not be open for another person, because we've all had those really highly strung point guards that are so paranoid about making a mistake that they don't throw any passes, because it's like, if this is not the absolute perfect 100%, it will get there on time, on target pass, I'm not throwing it. Then you have the ones that kind of are a little bit more risky, and it's like, eh, look, you know, 60% of the time that'll get through, we'll see if we can get this one through there. And you have the balancing act between the two of, geez, which ones do I like and which ones do I not like? And it depends on the game a little bit too, I think, as to what you like. Like, Jade Melbourne, like, throws some ridiculous stuff. And it's like, why on earth would you even think about throwing that? And it's like, oh, you can. Like, you find ways to be able to get that. But she sees the game on a different level to a lot of other people. How do we teach our players to have better vision as passers is where I'm heading with this. How?
Me? Okay.
I'm pointing at you. Not a visual medium, but you can see it.
That's tough. We've got to put them in positions to have to see that. So we've got to put them in constraint-based situations as often as possible. And we've kind of got to not coach them. As bad as that sounds, sometimes we've got to let them try and figure it out themselves. If they can figure out, if they, you know, turnover, you put them in the same scenario again, turnover. The little prompt that I tend to use is, think of what you would do different and let them just try and process it. If they don't get it again, well then, yes, I'm going to intervene and try and help. But if they can figure out that seeing that second or third line of defense is something that they need to be doing, they're more likely to then transfer that into a game and use it more often. Whereas if I intervene all the time, like we see it all the time with sort of like little under 12s games, off goes the player, she's dribbling down the court, and her head might be down a little bit and someone's open ahead and the coach yells out, pass it or eyes up or something like that. So they pick it up and pass it. But in that time, and I think you speak about it a fair bit in coaching courses, Rob, in that time that they've heard the message, processed it, picked up the ball and passed it, the person's not actually open anymore.
Well, the defense has also heard that.
Correct.
It's not stupid.
Yeah. So it's again, about teaching them where to look but not what to see, and trying to get them to get eyes, obviously eyes up, like, is really important. And I don't mind somebody yelling out eyes up, but, you know, pass it is always good. Almost always going to lead to a turnover.
Well, eyes up is usually Q4, there's someone open, you need to pass it to them too. So you've got to be careful as to how much of that you give them.
But at least that's also tapping into a skill set that they'll need. They need to dribble with their eyes up. So you're at least, you know, trying on that. But, yeah, keep putting them in as many situations as possible. But see, I'm also, especially at the younger age groups, I'm also okay with some certain types of turnovers. So if they're trying to play in pace and they are trying to kick the ball ahead, because that is frightening to kids of and when I say kids, I mean 12s through to 18s. The ball's in their hand, they feel that it's safe. If it's in the air, that's where it's scary because there's no control. So if they kick the ball ahead, you know, early, it's the right decision, but they overcook it or something and it goes out of bounds, I'll still applaud that. And so, because we want to play fast, we want to, you know, put heat on the rim in the first 8 seconds, we want to kick the ball ahead. So we've got to continue to champion good ideas to ensure that they happen again. Because if we see that turnover and they look over at you and you're cracking it because the ball's gone out of bounds or it's a turnover, they're never going to throw that kick ahead again. And now you've lost another pass that you had a real teachable moment. So, yeah, I think it's champion good ideas, put them in the scenarios as often as possible, and allow them just the freedom to try and figure it out as often as they can.
Curious on both of your thoughts on this, mainly because you work with the girls program predominantly more than anything else. My under-14s academy group at the moment, if I sit there and say we're going to throw behind-the-back passes, behind-the-head passes and all that sort of stuff, the boys like high-five each other and think this is the greatest drill in the world, whereas the girls almost go a little bit gun-shy on it. And it's like, no, this is not what we do here. Have you had any experience where that's been the case? I'll go to you on this one first, Jenna, like where you've experienced that, and what did you do to change it if you had that?
Well, I think that's one of the main differences between coaching boys and girls, is that boys, I feel like you need to reel in. They'll play quite chaotic and break out of things very quickly, whereas I feel like with girls, you need to allow them more freedom because they will stick to the structure and the exact instruction that you have given them. So yeah, if you tell them to be creative, it is hard to get that out of them, and I think that is the stark difference between boys and girls that I've seen in coaching.
And we almost have to set it up now that like the only pass you can throw is a behind the back pass, just to sort of force it a little bit more. And you know, they usually have the same, you know, they'll laugh about it and they'll throw it out of court and all that sort of stuff, which is fine. But after two or three attempts, it's like, oh, actually I can do this. It's not that hard. Like, is this a way where I can use this in games?
Yeah, well, I often put extra points on if they use those passes. So you get points because I like to have everything scored. If you have a behind the back or a hook pass, regardless of whether you get a score on that possession, you get a point for that. So it's that trying to just entice them a little bit. But all it takes is one person to do it. Everyone goes nuts, and then everyone sort of feels comfortable having a bit of a crack at it. Jenna's spot on in that it's hard to really draw that out of them because they don't want the spotlight on them, of good or bad, to be honest. But if we can put them in, it's not tricking them because they're not dumb, but put them into positions where, okay, you get your team will get an extra point and get you closer to winning, they're more likely to then get into that because they want to do well for their team. So, you know, we had it just on Saturday where we had we were working off an on-ball screen, and if they had a hook or a behind-the-back on the kickback pass, they got an extra point. And a team was absolutely killing the other team. I'm like, hey, we're going to need hooks and behind the backs to get this done. And you saw all of a sudden every pass was something. Now, they were horrible.
I was going to say, they still lost, didn't they?
But that was okay. And our reaction dictated whether they did it again. So all the coaches that were there, we had a bit of an army of coaches on Saturday. It was great. And they were all up and about. Like, they were, as soon as it happened, hey, that is exactly what we want from you. And you saw this almost a bit of pride, even though they'd turned the ball over, a bit of pride in what they attempted. And that's the real trick, I think, of trying to get girls out of their shell.
Yep, and I think it's a really important part of it, because we do want creative players that see the floor differently. And it's almost like put them in a position where the only outcome is what you want out of that outcome. And it is, it's kind of tricking them into getting it the right way. But a little bit of confidence goes a really long way there, because it's, oh, I can make that pass, or that did get the other person open. Now I've opened up an entirely different side of the floor that I didn't potentially have before, that makes a lot of sense. Is there any passes that either of you enjoy watching? Like when you think about the pro levels, anyone that you sort of sit there and say, I really enjoy watching how they pass the ball?
Marine Johannes.
Chelsea Gray.
Oh, yeah, good one. Like that, like both of those, actually. Like it's going to be a good Olympics coming up with both of those ladies making their rosters. But, yeah, Johannes, I'm a massive fan. She throws some ridiculous stuff. Like it is genuinely next level. The bit I love about Gray is that she waits passes like there is no tomorrow. Like her ability to just have it drop into their hand when it needs to drop into their hand is next level. I just wonder, was that something they were taught, or is it something they just built over time?
So I played against Johannes when she was a very young gal in France, and she's been throwing them since she's been playing. That's just her.
Yep.
She's always been, behind the head, behind the back, just... And when she was young, it was a lot of of turnovers.
Yep.
Like as a young player playing in the National League over there. I think she was lucky that she had coaches that still encouraged her and let her thrive in that. And now she's will be one of the best players at the Olympics coming up. It's her home city and it's going to be amazing to watch.
Yeah, and credit to her coaches, as you say, because they let her trial and error a lot of that stuff. Like I wonder how much we stifle creativity of players at times. It does genuinely wonder. I think I may have ended some careers looking back on it as a coach, that it's like, hey, you don't quite fit the mold of what I want as a point guard, so maybe you're not right. And it's like, actually, they could just be a different form of right. There's still times and places they could be really good for you. The fact they can see those types of passes to throw those types of passes, maybe they just weren't ready for me at the right time and I couldn't deal with it as a coach, but maybe they just couldn't quite get to where I needed them to as a player as well. But it
I
is
love
such
when
a,
you look back on your coaching career.
It's very reflective. it's amazing how many mistakes I've made, as it turns out.
But you learn from them all too.
Well, maybe I didn't. There's a couple that I think, I probably didn't learn from that one as quickly as I should have. Those types of things. But again, you can do
better
that
better late
time.
Than never.
Yeah, well.
Still no.
Yeah, maybe not.
That's like your hype woman.
Yeah, I know. Like, I never get this. I do genuinely look back and it's like, geez, how many players have I genuinely helped over the years, but how many have I really hurt at the same time? And I think about that genuinely. I'm not being facetious with this by any means, but it is genuinely a thing. It's like, well, was I the right person for that player at the right time? Or was I the wrong coach for that player at that time? Did I need them at a different... Like, would I have been better for them 2 years earlier, 2 years later, whatever the case may be too? I don't think you know until after you've seen the end product, like whether you could have changed some stuff. Like, I find the hard... And this is a different topic completely, but I find the in-the-now coaching to be the hardest part of it, because where you think you're making headway on something, the player may not feel the same way about it, or you just may not quite have the right goal in mind for them. You might be trying to turn them into something that they don't want to be, in which case, well, you're probably better off trying to turn them into something they do want to be, because they'll buy into that message a little better as well. And this relates somewhat to passing, I guess, that I don't believe I've ever been a great coach of point guards because I was never a point guard. So I look back on it, it's like some of the best players I've had have been point guards, but I don't think I had anything to do with them being good point guards. I think they were just good point guards that I had to have at the time, that we put a good structure or system or players around them, those types of things. So it's tough.
I think you can be a good coach to different positions.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah.
I just don't think I was.
Right.
That's more the point. Like, if you needed a slow-moving, undersized big, I'm your guy. Like, I can coach them, no problems, because I knew when to run, where to run, how to run, those types of things. But it just wasn't... Like, it just wasn't a position that I understood well. Post-play, had it. Like, no problems at all with that. But guards, they took a little bit longer for me to kind of work out what I wanted and how I wanted them.
I think the hard part with that is that, especially with point guard play, because of how it's evolved and relatively quickly as well. So back in the day, the point guards brought the ball up the floor and they facilitated offense. They scored if they were lucky, but, the scoring point guard wasn't, you know, wasn't something that a lot of coaches were brave enough to
They just wanted their point guard to have 4 points, 8 assists, 2 turnovers, exactly. And that was a good night for them. Like, it was that kind of thing.
But it evolved really quickly in that you need to be able to score as well, because that obviously helps facilitate your offense and all of those sort of things. But also then recognize when it's yours, when it's team, and that's not easy. I think what the important message, though, that's come out of what Jenna has said about Johannes is, as junior coaches, that is an absolute example of how we have to wade through almost a bit Shawshank Redemption towards the end when he escapes. You've got to wade through some stuff to get to freedom, right? Like, it is really difficult. You've got to take the hits. You've got to watch the turnovers. You've got to put up with all of that that comes with it to help this player on her journey to now what Jen said is going to be an incredible Paris experience for her. So I think that's the hardest part, is that, you know, it'd be really it's really easy to go back to, especially when we talk passing, to go back to, you know, two hands either side of the ball, step forward, extend your arms, thumbs down. You know, it's really easy to go back to that, but I don't think that helps us. And I think we shy away from creativity, and we shy away from, you know, one-handed push passing and things like that, because, yeah, it results in turnovers when they're young. But the point isn't that we're wanting to create this athlete for right now. The point is we want to create them to, you know, go to Paris or to go to the Olympics or play NBL 1 or play WNBL or whatever it is, and they need those tools to be able to do that. So, you know, like, I think it's really difficult as junior coaches to put up with that, especially in today where, you know, social media is a big part. Parents have a little bit more of a say than they used to. It's really hard to bat away that while you're trying to keep a goal focus for an athlete or athletes. But if you can, you know, imagine being those coaches that'll get to watch her run out at Paris. You know, imagine being able to sit in the crowd and watch that. Like, that'd be incredible. Like, to me, if any of the athletes that I ever had the pleasure to work with ever steps foot on the floor for the Opals, I'll lose it. I'll just be like a puddle. But that's, I think, where we've got to get to, thinking of it more that way. And it doesn't even have to be as a player, you know, if they become a coach. Like, there's some athletes that have been in my program that are now coaching, and I'm really proud of that. Like, I find that warms the heart. So, yeah, I think that is really difficult, like I said, to be able to put up with I'm sure there were plenty of turnovers. But, man, look at the result, right?
Well, and that's a big part of it. Like, we were watching an NBL 1 game on Saturday night, and it was like a throwback to the 2015 Vic Metro State team that I was in, because it's like my assistant coach was an assistant coach of one of the two teams, but two of the point guards in that team were playing against each other on opposite teams. Both still at their junior clubs, which is phenomenal. Like, that's near on unheard of. But we're playing against each other, and it was interesting watching the banter go back and forth between the two. And it's like, yeah, you've probably been friends for literally 10 years now, going through all that sort of stuff. But that's – I'll take away more of that. I could not tell you – actually, I know which one won, but I couldn't tell you either of their stat lines. But I can tell you that it was fun watching them play against each other again. And for me, like, that's the win. Like, it, you know, there's two kids that could have easily left and gone to a different sport because both of them were very good at the other sport, didn't, stuck it out, and are still playing now. So when you look at how we as coaches coach our players, the need to not stifle creativity and let them find their own path is such a valuable part of what it is. And the obvious tie into that is, well, are your kids enjoying it? Because if they're enjoying it, they'll stick around. And as coaches, sometimes you need that ridiculous drill where it's 2-on-1, but you're only allowed to throw the ball with your left hand and pass with your left hand and those types of things. can be a lot of fun for players to stick it out. And I find that's a really easy way of getting more and more fun into your practice, but still working on something that you need an outcome for, which is the passing sort of things. Like, how many of our passes, genuinely, when was the last time you saw someone in a game make a two-handed chest pass?
The only ones I can think of are like kicker heads.
That's it.
Like transition.
That's the only one I can think of as well. I don't think they happen in the half quarter anymore. I think it tends to be that push pass off the shoulder, step on the outside, even that sort of hook pass to get it from A to B, because the defense is getting bigger, stronger, more athletic.
Longer.
Like,
Jesus. More importantly, longer. Like, they're taking up so much more space than they used to. Yeah,
like we were talking about before we jumped on the podcast, like Izzy Magbeger block shots, it almost feels like with her feet outside the lane line and she still manages to get length onto to change shots. Like, it's incredible the amount the D has improved just physically more than anything else. The need for us to make better passes now to combat that is massive.
Yeah.
And we have to recreate that as best we possibly can. And sometimes the stupid little games that are stupid little games, like the picking in the middle type stuff, sometimes that's the fun stuff that you have to get done. Like, can you play that game with two basketballs so that both people have a basketball on either side, and now the defender is obviously a far better chance, but now you've got to start thinking about, well, where can I put that that's away from where they are? Those types of things can be a great way to just start off training sessions.
I'm going to go on a tangent here.
Yes.
But we're talking about passing, obviously, now. Yep. But if we look at junior basketball, Play HQ, what stats do they show?
Mm. Yep.
Scoring and minutes. Is that all they show?
Scoring. Fouls.
Fouls.
Yeah.
So there's no priority on passing. No one cares about passing because all people see are scoring and fouls. So for us to – and then you look at social media as well, it's highlights of people scoring threes or making a really tough bucket. We're not showing those nice passes that get to the nice bucket. So I don't think we have a priority on passing. So it's not surprising that we're not so good at it when there's no priority set on it at all.
Yep. I think it's a very good point. We've had it in the past where we've had parents track assists and those types of things, and the numbers are wild usually with their child involved. Like, it's the assist to turnover ratio is markedly different to when a different parent might do it, but it is something. I
maybe
think
it's NBA assists, not FIFA assists. There's a big difference.
That's a good point, but it is something that I think you can track on the bench. Like, it's straight away. It's, but even basic stuff like how many people acknowledge the passer. Like, it's so rare now that you're just a little point, just, hey, great find. But that goes a long way. It's like, hey, you know what? That made me feel good. I'll throw you the next one as well. Like, it's that kind of thing.
I do drills sometimes where if you don't acknowledge the passer, you lose points, just to try and make it a little bit more of a habit. But as coaches too, you know, we've got to get better as a fraternity of acknowledging that, you know, the pass goes, it's amazing, it's on target, it's on time. Catch, finish, everyone claps the finisher, which, don't get me wrong, important. You need to finish it. But the direction's got to go then to the passer of, hey, that's yours. You know, that's yours as well, because especially on Friday nights, it's not tracked. So we need to publicly track it almost and start making a big deal of the person who was able to make that right decision, make that right pass, to encourage more to do it.
And you're at the AAS with Phil Brown as the coach, and something that he was really big on was make the pass that makes the assists.
The hockey assist. Yeah, gotcha.
He was big on that, and it makes you read the game more because you see a post ceiling. No, I can't make this pass. I kick it to the wing. Yeah, then they've got the easy pass in. And he was very big on acknowledging that because it was a good basketball play. It doesn't get any statistic on a box score, but it gets your basket at the end of the day. And so he was big on that, and it's something that I've always remembered from him.
When we talk about receivers, did you ever do the drill with him?
Oh, gosh.
Where you had to run the lanes, and if you weren't looking, he'd throw the basketball at you?
Yes.
Okay, now just for clarity, coaches, please don't throw the basketball at kids anymore. Like, we are in a different time. There are child safe laws against this. However, I understand that it has happened in the past.
Look at the ball. It's really important.
Because that's one of the things, because, and the reason I bring it up, yes, I'm not saying do that, but what I am saying is the reason was we were trying to run the lane so hard that we forgot that we had to look back at the poor point guard who is under the pump. So it was a, well, if you don't look, here it comes.
How?
Yeah.
Oh, I can understand that. When we talk about, look, I'm not saying I haven't wanted to throw the ball at a kid from time to time, and I'm sure they've wanted to throw it back at me. When we talk about strike zone passes, like I hear you talk about that a lot, Zoe, what are you talking about when you talk about strike zone?
So strike zone, more so anything between shoulder and hip within the torso area. So it's not just about making the pass, it's also then on the catch and what you do with it there. If you bring it just sort of to your abdomen, I guess, it's easily stolen. So big part is trying to encourage to be able to make passes and catches outside of strike zone, you've got to use your feet. And we don't use our feet enough on either passing and catching. But being able to, you know, step through to put your body between the defense and the pass, or use the outside hand, that's another one that's really important, that with strike zone, like if you're right-handed but you're having to make a pass to the left, if you're passing across your body, it'll work now in, you know, 14s, maybe 16s. But as you start to get to 18s and above, that's a steal. That's gone. So being able to use the correct footwork, use the correct hand, and make those passes outside of that strike zone, and then catch them as well, gather them and get them outside of your strike zone as quick as possible. And when I say that, I don't, you know, because we want to catch to try and shoot the ball, of course, which of course is within that strike zone more often than not, unless you've got like a Shane Heal shot. But if you don't have that shot on, holding it in that sort of belly button area is a problem. And especially for bigs inside the paint, they'll get a rebound and they'll bring it down to their belly button. And so it's, you know, keeping it, you know, chin height, or, you know, using your footwork to get it outside of your abdomen to be able to make a pass to somebody else. So, yeah, it's tough. And you've got to be consistent because it is not something that they're consciously doing. Yep. It's something that, you know, catching the ball and dribbling with their preferred hand is at times very conscious because they know they're better at it. Putting the ball within the strike zone is generally not conscious. So, yeah, you've got to be really consistent with it and try and grab it every time that you can.
Yep. Jenna, we'll start with you on this one, but we will come to you on this too, Zoe. So the thing that a lot of our junior coaches are struggling with is when full court pressure comes, how to pass through that pressure, because that might be a case of they'll inbound the ball to their guard in the backcourt who gets monstered and double teamed straight away. How do you best suggest navigating that type of pressure up the floor? Is there like an angle you want them to pass the ball in from? Is there an angle or an area you want them to cut to? Is there anything you would look at teaching to negate high pressure defense?
Well, don't go to the corners.
Bingo.
Big no-no. And then you always want a pressure release behind and a pressure release in the middle. So don't go to the corners, go, I don't even know.
Seams.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the person who's inbounding it is then staying behind, so there's always that backwards pressure. And then you want someone in the middle as well. Also really important in a press or full court pressure is, as the receiver, don't stand still. You need to come towards the ball. If you're really flat-footed and waiting for the ball to come to you, it is going to be stolen. So make sure you're meeting the pass.
Yeah, that's a really big one. And I think that's not just backcourt pressure. That's, you know, anywhere on the court, in all honesty, is so many of our receivers literally stand and wait. And in particular, someone shoots the gap and gone, and all of a sudden all hell breaks loose.
Catch with your feet.
Yes, it is one of those things. Zoe, is there anything else you'd sort of teach in that type of situation?
Yeah, I teach a bit of sort of flipping the floor. So using that inbounder in a few different ways. So they can X cut through, so you can drive let's say you're on the right-hand side of the floor, they X cut through and you bring it then to the left-hand seam. I always teach that they are to play, ball handlers play in the seam, because at least if I say the seam, they won't be the sideline.
So when you say seam, just in case anyone's unsure where that is, where are you talking about when you say seam?
Old elbow and new elbow, if you were to run a line from baseline to baseline on both sides. So you can play that seam or flip it and come to the other side. But it also allows you, whichever seam you're in, if you've got a big lane rim runner, they need to be in the other seam, if that makes sense, to
opposite
help
seam.
Yeah, to help with your angle. So, yeah, you can X-cut it. They can set a terrace screen in the backcourt or play through like a gets. Or if you've got a really good
ball handling big
and play point four, then, you know, that works too. But flipping that side of the floor, because you find that the often backcourt pressure is almost like initial. Like, it'll happen really, really quickly, but if you can have one little breakout, then it just organically just backs off.
Fizzles.
Yeah. So if you can have that sort of action and flip the side of the floor, yes, it means you might have to change a side of your post or something like that. At the end of the day, that's probably the easier of the two options, but definitely play the seams as a ball handler. Lane runners, a really big one that we're fighting at the moment is they're doing a great job of running the lanes and owning corners, but then they're standing. And if ball handler is under pressure, or we can't, you know, kick the ball ahead or something, we need to pop back and be able to be an option. the whole point of owning the corners is if the point guard has been able to break their defender, and now they're looking to get feet in the paint to try and flatten out the defense and be able to either get that corner three or allow your point guard a lane to the rim. So, yeah, it's got to be, you know, own that corner but be available.
No corners back court, you can go corners front court.
Yeah.
Going to be on a T-shirt soon.
So I think that's probably really important. But I think the biggest thing is for our ball handlers to just get – comfortable being under pressure. You know, I think as soon as the pressure comes on, we pick it up. Like, it's we panic and we pick it up. We've got to put them in positions at practice as often as possible where they've got two people on them.
One of my favorite drills is 1-on-2.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Figure it out.
Yeah. It's good for their ball handling. Yep. They've got to work on that, and then it's good for the defense as well. And
that's the drill I've forgotten to post, but appreciate the reminder. But it is an interesting one too, is how often our guards don't, and I'm smacking guards here, and it's not necessarily just the guards' fault, but how often they feel like a token cut is enough to get them open. Mm. And with teams that are quite happy to face guard or switch out, if there's a screening type situation in the backcourt, a token cut doesn't get you open. You have to go and make contact with the defender. Like, I've always sort of said to my players, like, hit them before they hit you. It's go and find contact with the defense and find a way to get into, not a wrestling match as such, but try and find ways to find angles to get you open so that you can then go and get the ball. And that face guarding stuff in particular, like I tell players, like, play the game a little bit. Like, they can't see what's coming. They're in a position where they can't see, like, little
raise
fake catch,
hands.
Like those types of things. That's playing the game of just find ways to put them in a situation where they now have to guard you, not they're easily able to guard you.
But also, if it's off a score, I don't think our passers do a good enough job of utilising the baseline.
Yep.
We nail our feet behind the backboard and we stand there, and then we look at our guards going, come on, get open. We can help them by running that baseline or moving to help create those angles. You know, it's not easy. That's why I always make the everybody, no matter the position, have to feel what it's like to be in that position. Because obviously in a game we're not going to put our five in the one and expect them to get open and bring the ball down and facilitate offense. But they need to know what it's like when you don't do your job, which is help inbound the ball or be a good lane runner and be available or – you know, be available to flip the floor or whatever it is. You need to feel that So then you go, oh, I'm not doing that to my teammate.
And this, I stole it from Bestie actually. Like, he's really big on that inbound not going over split line.
Yep.
Like, you should be inbounding to the same side of the floor. And I think I've always done it, but I just never phrased it that way. And it's like, actually, that's a really good way. So there you go, Darren Depends. Like, it's not always me bagging
Derek.
On you. Derek. you know, you have given some great content out of this, which I do appreciate at the same time. So, but it is a really basic one of, like, try and inbound the ball to the same side of the floor. And if that means you have to flip as the inbounder, well, so be it. That's not the end of the world. Just be conscious of that.
Yep.
Now, you don't want to go back and forth like it's a track meet. That's going to cause some problems. But you do have to be conscious that it can only happen after a score too. Yep. So if it's a dead ball, then, hey, you are locked to that spot, in which case guards, work your tail off to try and find ways to get open there. So anything else from either of you on passing in particular?
Zoe said similar words, but something that I use a lot is, what would you do next time?
Yep.
What would you do different next time? And get them thinking about it themselves, because if we're constantly just saying it to them, they won't learn. Get them thinking about the situation that they're in, going back through their mind. They're like, oh yeah, that person was open, or yeah, I would take an extra dribble, or whatever it might be. But I think empowering our athletes to think about the game more so that they can open up that, not a visual medium.
Yes.
So that they can open up their vision more and see it for themselves, I think is a really good teaching tool.
Yeah, and sometimes you need to recreate that situation as well. Okay, everyone freeze, walk it back, stop here. Now what do you see? Like, those types of things are a great ways to – I love that way of teaching personally. Zoe, anything more from you?
Just be brave. Let them be creative. Put them in positions where creativity is encouraged, and understand that, unfortunately, as a junior coach, you won't get the benefit out of it probably. You might get some kids that really lock onto it and do a really good job. But, you know, when you get to see those athletes throw those passes at the next level, you know, that's what it's – hold on to that, because that's really exciting.
I have many leather-bound books and my apartment smells of rich mahogany.
Well, I did have a book for the book club. I started reading it and got about three chapters in and it sucked. So consequently, there is no book club this week. I am working on a new book.
You now. Just wanted to play the intro?
I really did. It's been a little while. But it is
a good intro.
It is. Like, it's probably our best work, to be completely honest. But it is one of those areas that, coaches, if you do have any books that you're reading that you think would be a great read for some of the others out there, please, little blurb, title, who it's by, what you liked about it, what your takeaways were, send it in. We'll put it on the podcast as well. I am reading a new one, Master of Change by Brad Stolberg, which I'm hoping is going to be slightly better than my last read. So, coaches, we haven't forgotten about book club. I do promise. A couple of you have messaged me and said, what the hell's happened? And it's like, yeah, that's completely my fault. I picked up what I thought
you
was
going to be. You kept having me on the pod and I don't read books.
Yeah, it didn't help. Like, barbecue cookbooks, but that's probably about it.
Yeah.
Coaches, that is that for the week. Thank you very much. Good luck with your coaching, and we'll see you all next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.